I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An open, online American conversation is what we do with global attitude. This one, and you're invited to join in, is with the intrepid pedestrian near the top of the world, the young Scotsman Rory Stewart, who walked across Afghanistan unarmed, mostly alone, after the fall of the Taliban in 2002. The book he wrote, The Places in Between, is not just the most celebrated travel adventure of the new century. It's assigned reading for freshmen here at Brown University. It's a sort of manual for global citizens in an alienated world, but a manual of what is the question? Besides courage, curiosity, stubbornness, and unfailing equanimity in the face of Kalashnikovs and wolves and cold. Among the pleasures of speaking with Rory Stewart was discovering that the meanings of this book, the East and West, war and peace politics of it, the human feeling with the Afghans, the mismatch of resources and authority in every relationship with Afghanistan, all these aspects of the story are still unfolding in Rory Stewart's mind. The man himself, and you can hear it in his voice, is a work in progress. Rory Stewart, The Places in Between is assigned reading by now in this war-weary presidential campaign season of 2008. And you yourself have become a symbol, I don't want to say poster boy, but the representation of something we terribly want in this country. What is it? What is it that this book somehow captures?
I'm not sure that I've become that kind of symbol. I think that my message is not actually a very attractive one. It's not one that resonates a great deal. Essentially, what I'm trying to say is that we need to focus on what we can do rather than on what we want to do. And that's psychologically quite difficult. The situation in Afghanistan, the situation in Iraq, these are intolerable situations. These are situations where people want to say, surely we can't just stand by with civil war imminent, 93% of the world's heroin being produced in Afghanistan, terrorists on the Pakistani border. Surely we ought to do something. And my response is, ought implies can. We don't have a moral obligation to do what we can't do. And that sense that you could be faced with an intolerable situation, whether it's in your personal life, an illness maybe, or whether in public policy, which you can't do anything about, is something that people don't really want to take on. People prefer to pretend they can do something or just do anything rather than admit that there's nothing they can do.
Come back to the power of the book, though. There's bravery, there's adventure here, there's an extreme sort of stubbornness, there's an above all, there's this unarmed, intrepid citizen walking, sort of Paul Theroux, off the train, on foot. And it's important. I wondered, is this the modern-day Kim, the modern-day Lawrence, sort of running the gaps, absorbing the culture? Is that the model?
I hope that this kind of walk isn't, in the end, about creating parallels with some grand historical figure, Kim or Lawrence or some 19th century traveler. I hope the point about walking is that it's something that is surprisingly democratic. It's something that we can all do. It's quite a simple operation. You just put one foot in front of another. And that really my ability to make it alive from one end of Afghanistan to the other is not a testimony to my own personal courage or to hardihood. It's really a testimony to the generosity of Afghans who chose to put me up night after night, who never robbed me, who never killed me, who often guided me. What I'm hoping, therefore, is that it's quite a straightforward statement, both about what's possible for all of us and also a statement about how the real respect is due to the Afghans themselves, and it's an acknowledgement of their autonomy, their independence, their freedom. That's why I hope that the book isn't really about putting me in the center of the frame so much as putting the context.
That's almost too modest, it seems to me. But it also, it's not quite what the book read. It's not quite what the book said to me. The book, for me, has a lot of nostalgia for the British Empire, for the power of the British accent, for that arch confidence you showed in confronting those wogs who might have overwhelmed you, might have killed you.
I don't think that's right. I think the journey that I made is quite anti-imperial in its nature. Mm. Imperial journeys are generally undertaken by people who dress as princes, who ride on beautiful horses. If you look at Lawrence of Arabia, he deliberately dresses not as an Arab peasant, he dresses as an emir of Mecca. Mm. He wears a beautiful gold braided cover for his kafir. He wears silk robes. He always has the finest horses or camels. Even Alexander Burnes, traveling in the 1830s, presents himself as a very wealthy Persian merchant. He travels with retainers. If I'm looking at anything, I'm looking maybe at an earlier period. I'm more interested in the notion of pilgrimage than I am in the notion of conquest.
You personally?
Yeah.
For me, there's a sort of kernel of the book in this fascinating footnote on page 247 about the old imperialism and the new, talking about the neo-colonialism. No, talking first about the bad old colonialism and its saving grace. The bad part was racism and exploitation. The saving grace was that British civil servants actually got to know the people, spent whole careers learning languages and small regions. In the modern time, you say, the colonialism of aid and CIA and special forces, there's a much greater degree of illusion around the whole project. People don't stay long. They don't dig very deep into the culture. Do I have it right? In the modern time, you say perhaps it's because no one requires more than a charming illusion of action in the developing world. If the policymakers know little about the Afghans, the public knows even less, and few care about policy failure when the effects are felt only in Afghanistan. What's to choose between these old and new colonialisms, and is there another way to do it?
I think at the time I wrote the book, I imagined that if you planned better, if you knew more, if you cared more, it would be possible to do better. That the failures in Bosnia, in Kosovo, in Afghanistan, in Indonesia that I'd seen were due to amateurism. They were due to lack of planning, lack of structure, lack of strategy, lack of commitment. But I then moved from Afghanistan to Iraq, and in Iraq I saw failure on such a monumental scale that I changed my view. I no longer believe that the problem is lack of professionalism. I believe these projects are intrinsically impossible, that the problem is not simply that we don't have imperial officers anymore, or that we don't create the culture wherein they could flourish, but that even if we had the context and the individuals, they too would fail, because the growth of nationalism, of Islam, the potential for resistance, the voices of people in Iraq and Afghanistan, their capacity to disrupt these kinds of projects are now such that even were you to transplant some Macedonian general of Alexander the Great and try to put him in charge of a swathe of Afghanistan, with all the charm, dynamism, charisma, and savagery that that would entail, he would still fail.
Hmm. You've changed your mind on the whole project then?
Yep. I changed my mind because of Iraq.
your service there and the record. Summarize it.
I went to Iraq in August 2003. I worked for Ambassador Bremer. I was made the deputy governor of two provinces in southern Iraq, working on behalf of the Coalition Provisional Authority. At the time, I thought that although the project would probably be semi-competent and semi-successful, we would still be able to outperform Saddam. In other words, we would create a society which was more stable, more humane, perhaps slightly more prosperous than that which had existed previously, that in the end, Iraqis would be better off after the intervention than before. And I was wrong. I discovered that the problem was not, as I had imagined, that people hadn't planned properly or they weren't working hard enough or they weren't professional enough. The problem was simply that Iraqis didn't want us, they didn't believe in the project, and that without that element of consent, without that element of active leadership and support, these projects are doomed.
The college students who are reading your book would have to expect that this war is going to go on if they're listening to the presidential candidates. More brigades to Afghanistan, some out of Iraq, but deeper into Afghanistan. How should they be dealing with this? How should they put these clues together?
I think the question which a college student, or which anyone might want to ask Senator Obama is, why do you think sending three more combat brigades to Afghanistan is going to make the difference? How does this tie in, Senator Obama, with your general view of the world, with your view of what went wrong in Iraq? Do you really believe that what's lacking in Afghanistan is that we're just 20% of foreign troops under the requisite number? Do you actually think the problems in Afghanistan are such that can be solved with that kind of deployment? Or is there something in our political system which compels a politician to increase troops, change strategy, talk about new initiatives, even when it's clear that the policy is a doomed one and that it's failed?
What are the questions for Senator McCain, who says, we've got to come out, but we've got to win?
Well, I don't think that I can see, on the basis of recent statements, a very clear difference between the policy of Senator McCain or Senator Obama in relation to Afghanistan. Fundamentally, both of them assume that it is within the power of the United States to build a nation in Afghanistan and that all that's lacking is the resources or the troops. That victory is possible. It's just a question of making a bit more effort or putting a bit more money or a few more soldiers on the ground. I think that assumption is mistaken. I do not think it is within the power of the United States to do that. And I think in trying to do that, they're likely to make the situation worse, not better.
May I say, with great respect, I read the book somewhat differently. It seems to me the book is a kind of statement that the old imperial and military ways don't necessarily work, but here's one brave man on foot, alone, showing at least that something can be done. Do you withdraw from that reading of the book?
I don't withdraw from that reading because I run a charity in Kabul. I've lived there for the last 2.5 years. I work with 350 people, and I believe strongly that something can be done. In that case, what we're trying to do is rebuild the center of the old city. We're setting up clinics. We're setting up primary schools. We're giving people vocational training in traditional crafts. We're supporting businesses. And we're building infrastructure, sewerage, water, houses. I believe an enormous amount can be done. I believe there's incredible power within Afghanistan or Iraq. I believe that Afghans and Iraqis are much more canny, competent than we acknowledge. That in the right conditions, with the right kind of leadership, with the right kind of resources, extraordinary things can be achieved. But they would tend to be at that level. They would tend to be at the level of a city or a neighborhood, not at the level of a nation. Because although a nation can be built, I don't think that's a job for foreigners. That's something that foreigners lack the power, the knowledge, the legitimacy to achieve.
You wrote a powerful piece in Time magazine this summer arguing that we should cut not only troops, but even dollar investment in Afghanistan, get out of the way of a much longer-term healing in that country. Also that we should get out of Iraq tomorrow. And yet the cover of Time magazine was headlined, "The Right War, Afghanistan." Sort these messages out.
I was pretty surprised by the cover. I think they could have done with a question mark at the end of that statement.
Had they read your piece when they wrote the headline?
It's interesting. I mean, clearly what you're picking up on there is that Afghanistan is somehow perceived as the right war. Iraq is the bad war, Afghanistan's the good war. And that even when you're presented with an article which seems to be arguing that there's not so much to choose between the two of them, it's very difficult for an editor to resist the temptation to continue to rehearse that particular cliche.
Young people are fascinated with this book, so am I. What would they do? What would I do in their coursework, their reading, their political study, their language study, to find their own places in between out there?
I think that the most astonishing things for me in my life have been found by getting out of cities into rural areas and living with families. I don't think it matters very much whether you're doing that in Afghanistan or whether you're doing it in West Virginia or Alaska, or whether you're actually simply doing it by living in a housing project in Boston. The experience of translating yourself from an environment in which you're comfortable into somebody else's environment that differs in some way, doesn't matter, linguistically, socially, economically, professionally, is, I found, probably the most important learning experience of my life, because much more than a book, much more an academic study, it gives you a sense of people who you're dealing with. It allows you to phrase the question, what would this person make of this? So if somebody's talking about healthcare, to be able to say not just what does this policy paper say about healthcare, but what would Bob living, or who I lived with in this community, make of healthcare? Or in my case, what did the headman of that village outside Bamiyan actually think about elections? How would he actually talk about elections? Has been incredibly empowering for me. It's that process of ventriloquization, being able to try, however inadequately, to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, to move a field of yourself.
How would you want a young student in college today to learn to see an alien culture in all its distance, but with its own innumerable varieties of Afghan experience, say?
What I want people to pick up is the way in which a culture can be very different to your own, and in many ways drab, alienating, perplexing, bewildering, but also incredibly attractive. That's the challenge with Afghanistan. The challenge for most of my colleagues working in Afghanistan is that, on the one hand, of course, it's very beautiful. You feel very strongly in communities that people are courageous, honorable, charming. On the other hand, of course, it's illiterate. Women are treated very badly. The government is extremely corrupt, criminalized. Communities are often very narrow-minded and conservative. How do you take that all on board? How do you develop a sympathy for a culture which will often have, inevitably, many elements in it which you find unpalatable or reprehensible?
And the answer?
The answer is people. The answer for me is shaking people's hands, looking in their eyes, trusting them, giving them the benefit of the doubt, realizing that in the end, if the person is capable of behaving in one area of their life with nobility, they're capable of doing that in all areas of their life.
I want to be just a little cheeky and say, there's another way to read this book. There's a marvelous scene toward the end of this book. You're leaving Bamiyan. Kabul is almost in sight, and you're set upon by these semi-official thugs. One of them blindsides you with a punch to your cheek, and, I mean, one is gasping at this point, but you stare them down. You say, how dare you? I'm a friend of your governor. I've lived in his house, which you hadn't. But there is this amazing rising of your own bluff against these guys, and they yield. It struck me as the imperial power somehow reasserting itself with all its old authority.
I think that is a reading which many Americans will feel, and I think that's got an element of truth in it, but it's also got an element of intuitive American suspicion of British narrative. It's very difficult for a British person not to be stereotyped as being part of a colonial endeavor. When I'm bristling, there may be a bit of that, and I'm sure there's a bit of that, but there's also a lot of just very normal human things. I'm tired, I'm angry, somebody's insulted me. And also there's an element of cultural understanding there. What I'm really doing, the reason I have the confidence to do that, is that I'm saying, how would an Afghan feel if he was treated like that? Would you treat an Afghan like that? And it's that, in a sense, that chip on my shoulder, that sense that I have all the time of, you wouldn't treat an Afghan like that, would you? You'd treat an Afghan with dignity, which gives me the confidence to challenge people.
Believe me, I was rooting for you in that scene, but I was also thinking, this is that old English magic, and it's Orientalism sort of in a new form.
I learned it when I was traveling across Iran with an Iranian friend who, in villages, would get very offended by the way he was treated by villagers. He would, night after night, say to me, this man is not treating us correctly. He should have put the tea there. He should have sat us there. That was rude, what he said. And over that period of 90 days with this guy, I began to develop quite a strong sense of what was customary, what was acceptable and what wasn't, just in the same way that if you were to go on holiday to France, you're going to realize that French culture is different, and if a Parisian taxi driver is grumpy with you, you may not get as offended as you are in America. Nevertheless, you've also got a strong sense that a Parisian is different, and that you would try to guess whether that would have been rude to a Frenchman.
What part of you that supported the war in Iraq and originally have you left behind, and would you want the rest of us to repent?
I think my fundamental problem there is that I had too much confidence in the power of the West to transform. I really believed that all that we needed to do was get our act together. Just be a bit more organized, do a bit more strategy, get a few more resources. We could do it. And I think I've realized that we are delegitimized. We do not have the right or the support. We cannot catch people's imaginations to do these kinds of things. That the problem isn't just a problem of resources or will. It's a problem of consent, and I think it's humility that we should take away. The only wisdom is the wisdom of humility.
Rory Stewart, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for this enthralling book, The Places in Between.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks to Anne Crapu and Paul McCarthy, who produced and edited this conversation. And now it's your turn. Please pitch in your own comment to or about Rory Stewart and The Places in Between on our website at www.radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for taking part.